This coordinator, I'd like to inform parties today's conference is being recorded. If anyone has any objections, you may disconnect at this time. You may go ahead. Thank you.
Thank you. Could we have a roll call?
Certainly, Alan. Good morning, good afternoon, good evening, everybody. On the call, we have Sergi Gorbunov, Michele Nilon, Mikey O'Connor, Alan Greenberg, James Bladel, Ted Suzuki, Barry Cobb, Paul Diaz, Helen Laverty, Tim Ruiz, Jeffrey Eckhouse, Mason Cole, and Cheryl Langdonor. And for staff, we have Marika Koenigs, Margie Milam, and Glenn de Saint-Gerie. Have I left off anybody? Then we have apologies from Alain Doulan, Mike Pelage, and Tatiana Kramsova. And we have been trying to get through to Siva Mutasami, but he's not answering his phone. Is there anybody that I've left off? Apologies. Thank you, Alan.
Thank you, Glenn. All right.
Excuse me, Ron Wickersham joins.
I'm sorry, who was that?
Ron Wickersham.
Ah, okay. All right, just let me pull up the right screen here. I seem to have far too many open. All right, I would like to add one item to the agenda. Initially a short discussion. We may have to come back to it another time for a longer discussion, depending on the feelings of the group. The issue is transfer of domain names between registrars after expiration. The original request for an issues report identified whether the question of whether we should allow transfer during the RGP. It did not discuss transfer prior to the RGP, but after expiration, because at the time, I and most of the other players who were involved in the discussion believed domains were transferable at that point. Some very strong statements were made by ICANN during the EDDP discussion that there is no question that a registrant can transfer a domain post-expiration prior to the RGP. It became obvious as we started these discussions once the issues report was written. The issues report was silent on the issue. With Rob Hall's presentation and a number of other discussions, that because WHOIS data is very often altered or because the registrar no longer allows access to the domain by the registrant, transfer is effectively not allowed. Does this group believe that the issue of transfer post-expiration prior to the RGP is something that we can consider? Or do you feel we must go back to council for expanding the scope to look at that?
I'm sorry, Alan, it's Jeff. Can,
yeah.
you, sorry, can you repeat that one more time? I just want to be, I thought I missed, might have missed a word or two. Can you just repeat that one more time, please? Sorry.
I don't guarantee I use the same words, but.
Oh, okay. You can get it close.
The question is, does this group believe that it is within our scope to look at the transfer between registrars of a domain post-expiration prior to the RGP? That was a right which ICANN believed everyone had, and in fact, when the issues report was requested, the ALAC believed everyone had, but in fact is not the case in many cases because of how WHOIS is altered and or how registrars or resellers allow access to their databases by the registrant at that point. It's certainly something that would have been there if we had, if anyone had realized what was actually happening, but we can't change history, Jeff.
Yeah, okay. So I think my quick answer to that is no, and the main reason being that somebody can correct me, but I think this has been a topic of other discussions within the inter-registrar transfer policy discussions and is being addressed there. And I might be saying something up, but I thought that transfers after expiration were still allowed, but that should be something, within the transfer policy, and that I think another reason why not for us, since it's in another group sort of purview, that it might push us as our working group off course and kind of off our charter if we went that direction. But I also think the main reason being that another group is looking at it.
Okay, I have Mikey, but one comment. Technically, it is still allowed. It's just de facto not something one can do because very often the WHOIS data has changed. And therefore, the person from the registry's point of view is no longer the owner.
Well, I wouldn't say it's de facto because I know that for us, and we do an incredible large number of transfers in and out, that it is allowed and it does happen. And I know that if we do it, that means registrars on the other side are doing it because it's a two-way transaction. So I do believe that it does go on. I wouldn't say de facto it does not happen.
Okay, I was not trying to make a blanket statement.
I just want to say that it does exist and it is allowed, and you're correct. And I just want to say that it does happen. Go.
Okay, we had first Mikey and then Marika.
Yeah, this is Mikey. I think we've got practically the whole core IRTP gang on this call. So I'm going to speak, but Paul, James, Tim, et cetera, feel free to correct me. You know, the way you framed that issue, Alan, I think that it would be fine for this group to go ahead and flesh it out for the IRTP folks. We're certainly not looking at it right now, and I'm not sure that particular issue is in our charter either. So...
Yeah, I did not think
clarification at a minimum would probably be a pretty good idea.
Okay, Marika.
Yeah, this is Marika. I also wanted to confirm that it's currently not on the agenda of the IRTP working group, and I don't think it's either an issue that is covered in any of the future IRTP issues. But having said that, at the time of the issues report relating to the question on the possibility of a transfer during IRTP, it was suggested that possibly that question could also be addressed by an IRTP working group, but the decision was taken by the council at the time to include it in the work of this group, but with the caveat that, you know, the group might establish, you know, the parameters for making a transfer possible, but maybe the IRTP group would be a better place to flesh out the technical details of such a process if it would be decided that that will be desirable.
And the same could well be true in this case if we decide it is within our scope to look at.
Yeah.
Jeff?
Sorry, I'm just going through some ICANN documents, and I hope, Marika, you could just back me up that on the inter-registrar transfer policy, I believe the advisory was somewhere in 2007, is that registrars are prohibited from denying a domain name transfer request during the auto-renew grace period. There are some caveats around that, but I would take a look at that. I think it was a September 07 advisory before we decide to put it in scope or not, because it might be a contractual compliance issue versus a working group issue.
If you can give us a firm pointer to where that is, that may well take this off the agenda completely at that point.
Okay, I'll look through. Hopefully maybe Marika or somebody at ICANN
okay.
will find it faster than myself.
Sounds like we may have addressed the problem easily. Thank you. Marika still has her hand up, or from before?
Oh, sorry. I can just take it down. But just one note, because I need to look up the advisory, but if I recall well, I think that had something to do indeed with reasons for denial of a transfer, and I don't think it specifically addresses the issue that Anand raises. Because I think if I understand Anand correctly, you know, he's making the point that a transfer is allowed, but because of the practice of changing the WHOIS details, the registrant at the time of expiration actually cannot initiate the transfer because he's no longer recognized as being the registrant.
That is correct, and it's slightly more convoluted than that, because even in cases where the registrant's name may not have been changed in WHOIS, the domain name may no longer be within their control on their control panel, as it were, within the registrar or within the reseller. So they may not have the mechanism to request it, even if they're still the registrant of record. But let's look at what the advisory says specifically and then come back to it if necessary. What I seem to be hearing is if indeed there is a problem which is not covered by other policies, then it might be something this group considers within scope.
Alan, just to note
that... Am I misstating?
Alan, this is Tim.
Jeffrey just put the link into the Adobe Connect.
Okay, thank you.
And I can put those two... copy those first two reasons that it's relating to in Adobe Connect server and can see that as well.
Okay. Tim, you were trying to get in?
Yeah, just a point of order about
that.
The group, I would just caution against this group deciding what, solely what's in scope. So if the group decides that they do believe it's in scope, then I would, and this is probably what you're implying, that then we'd want to go back to the council and make sure that we get things updated appropriately through the council.
Yes, that was shorthand for that. If this group was wildly opposed to it, I think the message we would take to council or not bother taking it to council would be different than if this group felt generally it was something that's reasonable and go back to council to update the scope.
Got it. Okay, thank you.
Yes, that's what I meant, and thank you for telling us what I meant.
Mikey? I'm going to stick with my first thought, which is that I'm reading the IRTP charge, and I really think that the IRTP charge is fairly narrowly cast and is not aimed at what you're describing. So at a minimum, I think it's worth our time to expand the description of the problem and follow Tim's advice to maybe go back to the council for where this ought to be addressed, so that I guess what I'm concerned about is that both groups think that either the appropriate place is the other group, or that something falls through the cracks.
No, I think what I generally heard in the last few comments was that the IRTP may be a good home to work out the mechanics if a policy needs to be changed, but that whether it needs to be changed is something we could discuss if it's not already established and just a compliance issue. Did I phrase that roughly the way the group had moved?
Well, this is Mikey. That's fine with me.
Okay. Any other questions on this? If not, I think we have some homework to do, but we will come back to it at a future meeting. Okay, the next item is the schedule, the SOL meeting, and what we do about a possible conflict. Marika, would you like to review the problem?
Yes. At the latest version of the schedule, some things have been moved around, which means that the post-expiration domain name recovery workshop or status update is now scheduled from 1:30 to 3 o'clock on Monday. It's still partly scheduled in parallel to the CCTLD fast-track meeting, but now it also conflicts for half an hour with the AXO meeting, which is due to start at 2:30. So the question for the group would be, should we try to find another place for this, for the post-expiration meeting, which might be a challenge because it's already, the schedule is already quite overloaded and undoubtedly, it will probably conflict with another meeting.
Marika, what's the overlap with the CCTLD fast track? At the beginning of it?
Yes, that's at the beginning. That meeting starts as well at 1:30, and
oh,
I think
okay.
it goes until 2:30.
Okay.
And then the actual meeting starts at 2:30. So the second option would be people say, well, half an hour overlap is not, you know, not such a big deal. We just join after, you know, our meeting has finished. I think for now the topic that's on the table for discussion there, I think, is as well IDN fast track. Or another option would be to limit the post-expiration meeting to 1 hour to avoid overlap.
Yeah, of course, we don't know at this point who is going to be formally participating in the AXO meeting. It could well be some people from this meeting, from this group. What's the general feeling in the group? Limit it to 1 hour or try to move and hope that we don't have too many other conflicts as a result?
Alan, this is James.
Oh, sorry, there were hands.
Question for Marika, and I know you're doing the best you can, Marika, and to scramble, but where are you seeing this level of detail on the SOL schedule? On the posted SOL website, you know, we're just kind of seeing still some daily summaries and not a breakdown of different time availability.
Yes, this is still in the internal schedule, and we're still working out some last details, but I just already wanted to flag it so that, you know, the group can decide whether they would like to try to find another place for it or limit the meeting. But as I said, I mean, the schedule is still in flux. I just noted that the actual meeting had moved and already wanted to note that to the group. But I think the schedule is supposed to come out in the next couple of days.
Mikey?
Okay, and then a question for Alan would be, did we determine, help me with my memory here, did we determine at a previous meeting that this would be an open-to-the-public workshop or it would just be a continuation of this group's activities or half and half, or I'm trying to figure out if whether or not we need that extra half an hour or if we can safely drop down to 60 minutes?
This was specifically supposed to be a meeting open to the public to update and get input.
Okay.
And we have to, in the next little while, flesh it out a fair amount. There was some discussion related to whether this group should try to meet at Seoul. There is nothing on the agenda right now, and the question is, for those people who will be in Seoul, should we try to arrange something? May well not be on the formal agenda, but we may have to try to figure out something that works if we want to try to meet face-to-face.
This is James again, and just from, you know, from personal perspective, is that it's probably too late to be adding new things to the SOL calendar, and then I would then support the idea of limiting the meeting to 1 hour.
Okay. Any other comments? I know Marika would like us to just limit it, because that's going to be a lot easier than trying to move it. Tim, you were one of the ones who, in conjunction with me, decided we really needed an update in Seoul. I know we're not as far ahead as we had hoped to be by now. What's your thought?
Yeah, I think that probably the best answer is just to limit it. You know, I have a lot of issues with the way we schedule things at these ICANN meetings, but that's neither here nor there at this point, but it seems like the most practical thing would be just to limit it to 1 hour. And make do with that.
Any
this is Marika again.
Yeah.
Looking at the schedule, but then it would get very late. There would be another option, possibly, to do it from 5:30 until 7. I see that there. So I would need to check if there's actually a room available. But on the schedule, I think most meetings tend to finish at 5:30. That would be another option. But of course, the risk might be that after a long day, you know, you might not have many people showing up at that time.
7 is awful late, especially given receptions and various other things that happen on Mondays. So I would tend to say that's a bit too late. We could do that for a private working group meeting, of course. Depending on how masochistic we are.
What I can do, I can ask if, you know, they see any other slot that would work for 1.5 hours and see if, you know, there's any place in the schedule that would be suitable. And if so, share that with the group on the mailing list to see if that would work. And alternatively, then, if not, limit it to 1 hour meeting.
James?
Yeah, I mean, before we have Marika go off on that. I'm thinking, Marika, that that's going to be quite a daunting task, and it's going to send you off on a lot of different rabbit holes. I mean, if we can agree as a group that we're willing to limit this to an hour, I think that should settle it, correct?
Cheryl, he works for me.
Any other comments? I tend to agree also, so let's save you some work, and we'll just change it to 1 hour.
Great. Thank you.
Okay. If we could, while we're on the subject of agenda, take a straw poll of if we could find a reasonable time, which may be slightly out of normal meeting hours, would this group want to try face-to-face for those of us who will be there? Resounding no sound. Do I take that as a no? James says he doesn't want to meet.
It's nothing personal. It's just that the schedule is, it's just, you know, I mean, we've already taken over the weekends before and after, and now we're having 6 and 7 o'clock breakfast meetings, and it's just getting a little, you know, it's just getting pretty overloaded.
I don't know what that symbol means that's beside James' name now. He's leaving the screen. He's stepping away. All right, we have no support and one very negative, so let's next time we'll think farther ahead if we want to do this, if we're still around at the next meeting. Okay, back to the agenda. Review of the public comments. Marika, you've put up a very nice spreadsheet here. Would you care to suggest how you foresee us walking through this?
Yes, this is Marika again. Basically, it's part of trying to be more structured about how we deal with public comments and how working groups take them into consideration. We've been trying in you know, different initiatives, also like new GTLDs, but also, for example, the FastFlux working group. We've tried to come up with some kind of method or matrix to demonstrate and facilitate review of public comments. So what I've tried to do here is group the different comments received based on the summary and analysis into this grid. Basically, they're grouped together on you know, under the different questions, and then at the end you have the more general comments that were raised. And the idea would be that the working group goes through each of these comments. Basically, you know, provide an opinion, might be we agree, we don't agree, you know, because as well the idea would be to see if any of this information might be relevant for inclusion or consideration, of course, in the report. And then I added as well a category for next steps, follow-up, which might be some issues might require more discussion or more investigation, or it might be just a point saying, well, this point should be included in the initial report or things like that. So that's the idea behind it.
Okay, I have one question to ask the group before we start. There is at least one and perhaps several respondents to the comment periods who are registrars or resellers. Do we want to note that as we're looking at the comments or simply treat them as interested respondents the same as anyone else? I note all the participants in the work group itself did not respond.
Got a hand up, Alan.
Yeah, James.
Yeah, and I think that you know, if there's some uniformity and you wanted to show them as separate or different, that's you know, my question is, are you going to do that to other stakeholder groups as well, or are we singling out registrars in particular? Or I'm just trying to understand precisely where that's coming from.
The reason I asked the question is because we're talking about a policy which, as Mason has pointed out to us a number of times, if we make any change, it is going to have impact on registrars, no matter how compliant they are with the with the best practices. And therefore, one presumes there is a vested interest in from their point of view in the outcome, as opposed to perhaps a more disinterested bystander. Marika?
I'm sorry if I can respond,
yeah,
Alan.
Okay.
I just, Respectfully, I think everybody in the ICANN community and participants on PDPs had some interest, and that if we get to a point where we want to quantify that some are more interested than others and then singling out those groups in comments, I think that that starts to, in my opinion, go against the purpose of the public comment. So I would say either treat them separately or group everyone by a stakeholder group,
okay.
One or the other.
To the extent we can identify them, we can't always.
Yes.
Yeah.
Well, if we can't identify them, then they would go into either, you know, the at-large or non-commercial.
Marika?
Yes, this is Marika. I just wanted to point out that as well, one of the comments that has been included here is the one, it is the constituency statement from the ICC. They happen to submit their statement as part of the public comment, so it has been summarized there. But the group might want to consider taking their comments together with all the other constituency statements once they have come in, and the group might want to consider, you know, developing a similar kind of matrix to review and consider those comments. That's
okay.
A question for the group. Should we keep the IPC comments in here, or you know, would it be better to take them together with all the other constituency statements once they have come in?
Mikey?
This is Mikey. I just wanted to sort of echo what James said. I think that we either want, because I certainly have an interest as a registrant. I'm not in this set of comments, but other registrants certainly are, and so I think I like James's notion of an even-handed approach, either no identification or identify everybody, but singling one out doesn't feel right to me.
Okay, Jeff?
I'm actually just want to disagree on not that, on the point that we don't, mine isn't an either-or option. It's, I think, that we just, the people submitted the comments as is, and this sort of worksheet is supposed to help us with some organization, but you don't know, it's very tough to read into certain people. They might be saying, as a registrant, they might be, you know, have other interests. I think just to leave it as is, that's how they submitted the comments, I think makes the most sense. Any interpretation from anybody can lead to, you know, somebody saying, oh, I'm going to discount that because they're this or that. So I would just, my recommendation is not to treat every, it's to just leave it as is.
Okay, Michele?
Mikey, yeah, that's where I'd be too.
Okay. I'm just echoing what the others said. I mean, I'm a registrant, a registrar, and a reseller, so if I had submitted a comment, how the hell would you classify it? Come on. Like, anybody who goes to the trouble of submitting a comment has a motive for submitting it, regardless of whether they're taking it from a registrar perspective, a registrant perspective, user perspective, or whatever. I mean, it's just thankful that somebody actually took the time to respond. I think that's, and take whatever comments they have, and let's deal with them.
Okay. Any other comments?
This is James. I just want to retract my earlier statement and say I agree with Jeff and Mikey.
Okay. Done. Shall we start?
Cheryl here, Alan. What about Marika's question as to redacting or removing the IPC and revisiting it as a statement from constituency?
Sorry, I forgot that. Thank you, Cheryl. I would support that, since we are going to have to be looking at the constituency statements when they come in, assuming there are others. Then I would support taking it out of this analysis. Any other thoughts? I can be overruled.
This is Mikey. The only thing that might goof that up is anybody from the IPC on the call? Do we know whether that's sort of the official constituency statement or just somebody who's...
We can find out.
This is Marika. I'm not from the IPC, but it was labeled as the constituency statement.
Who submitted that?
I will need to check that. Let me get back to you on that one.
Okay, I was just trying to find the...
I guess the only issue would be if there are two IPC statements at the end of the day. If you did that.
Yeah. Perhaps we should ask them.
Well,
what a concept.
If it actually said it was, then it is. I just don't find one with a name that I recognize for IPC in the comments.
It was submitted by Paul McGrady, and it basically attached, please find the IPC comments, the questions posted by the post-expiration domain name recovery working group.
Well, since we're asking exactly the same questions in the request for constituency statements, I think for the moment we will assume it's a constituency statement, and if not, we'll do some backtracking after the fact.
I'm happy to contact this person to confirm that they're not submitting another statement as part of the constituency statement. So.
Okay.
That might be the safest option.
Alan?
Yep.
Hi, Mason here. I've got my hand up there. Yeah, sorry.
No.
I'm sorry. I was just confused on the question that led into this. What exactly were you trying to answer?
The IPC submitted a paper which they said was their constituent, was the position of the IPC. The question,
so we're just trying to clarify,
should we consider it today with the public comments, or should we fold it into the constituency statements, which are coming shortly from the other constituents?
So we're just trying to ask. We're trying to answer the procedural question.
That's correct.
Okay.
Ron?
I think that was my question. I was only going to ask, it's not to rank that public comments are in a different category than constituency ones, and we have to pay more attention to one kind of comment than another? The case? Or?
Well, partially to the extent that this is supposedly representing the whole constituency and not under one person's name. So it has more weight from that sense. But I was thinking of it not so much from having weight, but just a matter of process to consider them at the same time and in the same process with the other statements, the other constituency statements.
Okay.
I think we have general consensus to delay unless someone wants to represent the other side. So we will exclude these comments in our analysis today and fold them into the into the constituency statements, but in parallel, we'll double-check to make sure this is the statement and not a statement from them. Are we now ready to start, or is there something else I forgot? Should answer the phone. Okay. Marika, can you try to walk us through this then?
Yes, happy to do so. So the first comment raised to question one, whether adequate opportunity exists for registrants to redeem their expired domain names. Two people said there, yes, there is sufficient time and opportunity. I don't know if you want to take them one by one or just take the three we're considering in this this category together.
This is James.
Yes, James.
Hi. Quickly, was trying to understand. We're not actually doing any kind of a deep dive on these particular topics at this time. Is that correct?
We're just trying to get a feel for what people have told us before we go into the process of talking about them ourselves.
Okay.
I mean, in one case, for instance, I when we come to it, I disagree with Marika's summary of the statement, and I think we want to bring out those kind of things. And
okay.
or do we need to go into any more depth because we don't understand the point?
I'm thinking that, you know, personally, I'm looking at this list and I haven't had a chance to read through it yet. I thought that perhaps, you know, since I'm the first time I'm seeing it, if we're not going to discuss the merits of each individual item that, or their, as you said, or their category, you know, what category they belong to, then maybe it's more of a question of, are we just doing a read-through at this point, or?
Well, I was assuming that since the document was distributed before last week's meeting, people have at least scanned it. Maybe I'm wrong on that.
If I'm the only one, then I certainly deserve the scrutiny that I've earned.
Okay. I'll stand with you, James.
Well, you may not be.
James has his hand up, but I have a question for Marika first. You have one of the columns titled Work Group Opinion. Do we really want to try to state opinions on the comments at this point?
I'm happy to label it working group views, or it's more a way to capture, you know, what the working group thinks or what the opinion is on a certain comment, as well, taking that forward maybe in the follow-up discussion to these questions.
I mean, if you look at the first one, I'm not sure, you know, how we would rate, what kind of comments we would make, other than I think one of those comments, if I remember the actual words, but it's not reflected in your summary, is one of them said, my registrar gives me adequate opportunity, or something like that.
Yeah, because I should point out, of course, this is a summary of a summary, and the assumption is, of course, that people have reviewed the full comments, and if not, at least the summary and analysis, because I just tried to fit it here into this Excel sheet without taking up too much time.
That wasn't a criticism. It was just that I did note on one of them, and I'm not sure it's the one we're talking about here, that extrapolations were made from their experience with a particular registrar.
Mm-hmm. Correct. I think that comment comes later where the person was specifically singling out a registrar with whom he had bad experiences.
Yeah, it may have been the comments about the notices. I'm a bit at a loss what to know what we would put in these, other than to say noted. I mean, there are several people saying, yes, there's adequate opportunity, and some people saying there's not adequate opportunity. And I think one of them actually said it's very inconsistent. That would tend to tell me that this is something that is worthy of our discussion, because it's there's not unanimity in the community.
And this is Marika. On the third point, what the person raises there, and I think that's something that was raised as well in the issues report, he basically saying that there's no sufficient opportunity, as there are no obligations to grant ATP or RTP. So that might be an issue for the group to consider or discuss.
Okay, the implication being, if there's no requirements, then it's really a matter of business models and in the extreme, the whim of the registrar or reseller. Cheryl, you had your hand up?
Yes, I was just going to see what the group thought about, rather than an analysis, view, opinion, however we want to label it, of whatever depth, deeps or otherwise, that we look at them in question lumps, and perhaps under question one we could tease out from the work group now whether or not the next step would be that from this set of responses there is or is not reason to assume that there is or is not sufficient opportunity or too much inconsistency. So sort of lump them together rather than analyse them at great depth, which, as Marika points out, is, you know, a summary of a summary of a summary anyway.
Anyone else on their views on how to proceed? In the absence of any other views, I will accept what Cheryl said, which I think is try to come up with a consensus of, is this an issue that we need to look at in more depth based on these comments. Is that a summary of your summary?
Pretty close to it.
Okay. You have either hands up or people speaking, or ticks or crosses. I would say, based on at least one comment saying there is not opportunity, another one saying it's inconsistent and we can't tell, that this is something we need to discuss further. No violent objection. Let's proceed to question two.
So question two, whether expiration-related provisions in typical registration agreements are clear and conspicuous enough. Here there are a number of comments as well grouped together. Do you want me to try to summarize it at the comments, or?
You could try that. I will issue give my statement. I don't think I don't know about your summary of the summary, but in the summary I don't think you characterized BL's comments accurately. the words you use were there, but not really in the context you used them.
Okay, so I'm happy for you to summarize it as you.
Okay, well, your summary basically says BL says that they knew they were entering into a time limited contract at the beginning. I don't believe that. I think we need to go back and look at BL. I think BL's comments were much more that it is there are problems. I think the time limited contract was in relation to one specific thing in that comment. So I think we need to revisit that one, but I don't think we need to do that at this moment. He or she made quite a long comment.
I'm looking back at his original comment, and it's very short what he puts down for 2 and 3. He puts down, when a registrant takes the domain, he enters into a time-limited contract with the registrar. He pays for 1 year or 2 years or 10 years, but from the outset he knows how long it will be. Any other way would break common commercial rules. As a courtesy, the registrar might give notice of pending expiry, nominate or so for the UK domains, but the registrant should be responsible for renewing it in a timely fashion.
Okay. Maybe I misread the wrong comment. Okay, I withdraw my statement until I can read this again and find out why I disagreed.
I think that covers the first commenter.
Okay, I did have. Sorry, I want to go back for a second just to make a note. Something that I noted as I was reading the individual comments, we never said in the call for comments explicitly we were talking about GTLDs. Now, it might be implicit in the fact that this is a PDP of the GNSO, but I'm not sure everyone understands the intricacies at quite the same level. So I think we are assuming that these comments all apply to GTLDs, but in fact some of them might be in reference to CCTLDs. That has certainly been the case in the one-on-one discussions and workshop that we had. So just something to keep in the back of people's mind as we go forward with it. Marika, back to you.
Yeah, so the second person basically says as well that the agreements are pretty clear about expiring domain names. The third person actually says that they're not conspicuous enough and auto-renew provisions for cancellation are antiquated or unclear. And a fourth person basically says that registrars seem to need many words to describe that registrants have no rights at all after expiration.
A mixed bag at best.
Yes.
Sounds like another one that was the question that was sufficiently well worded that we need to come back and talk about it in more depth. We certainly have the range of answers from everything is completely clear to everything is completely confused. Any thoughts before going on? Cheryl.
Just a quick one, Alan. Of course, this is one of those issues that may bleed over to notice the terms I'm using very deliberately, bleed over to future work where you get end user or consumer requests on simple, clear language and concise contracts. Certainly something that's happened in the telco industry in a number of countries. It comes back to what consumers expect in terms of their rights in a contractual basis and that clear synopsis and short form words need to be used, all that sort of stuff. So it might be one of those things that is noted but not quite in the output of this work group, something that can be done much about.
Understood. In the absence of Michael Pelage being here, I will use one of his statements of what we should be aiming at is clarity and predictability. And if you look at the range of answers here of it's hard to find something and people have absolutely no rights whatsoever, that certainly shows one side of it and countered, of course, with the other one saying the agreements are pretty clear.
Cheryl, just responding again, Alan, I mean, it comes back to a simple test that one can do in all sorts of consumer relationship exercises and actually ask how many people even read a contract before saying yes. The fact that it's clearly outlined what your rights are or are not if you fail to read it means you don't know about it. Not the problem that we're dealing with here, but a fact in the real world, and I'm not sure that we can in any way, shape, or form fix it, but we can, you know, so note it.
Given that we know there are certainly at least some resellers and perhaps registrars who make sure to not, or do not make sure that their agreement is accessible before signing, becomes even more interesting. James?
Yeah, real quickly here, without getting into that latter point, because I'm not sure that's a tangent we want to get off onto, but the question about, and I'm going to stick up for Mr. Pelage a little bit here. I think the word he uses is not clarity, but it's transparency.
Okay.
And I think that, you know, that they're not necessarily one and the same, is that we, you know, if you can see what is happening and you don't like it, well, you still had a chance to see it, you know, I think. So it's just a minor distinction, I think, that I just wanted to. And so everybody, please, and when we're in Korea, please let Mike know that I stood up for him. Thank you.
Noted. McGailey. McGailey? Are you there?
He can't have muted himself. I don't believe it.
I did mute myself, sorry.
Good lord,
sorry,
man.
Sorry. No, what was I going to say? Oh, yes. No, it's just in terms of the thing with agreements and people not seeing agreements. I mean, just as a kind of a point of information, a lot of the stuff to do with piracy and everything else is within the European Union, it's pretty much moot because we're all obliged under European law to publish certain information on our websites, including tangible contact details, and there's also plenty of case law about forcing people, ensuring that people have actually agreed to terms and conditions before they enter into anything. So from the European registrar's perspective, I think we're all pretty much doing that. If not, we're flouting national and European laws, never mind anything to do with ICANN policies.
Noted. All right. No one objected to my summary of on question two, saying that there was a wide range of responses, which indicates we have more talk to do. It's not clearly not very cut and dry. No hands. Question three.
Question three, whether adequate notice exists to alert registrants of upcoming expirations. Most commenters seem to agree that there's enough notice being given, and several of them point out that if no notice is received, it's actually due to inaccurate WHOIS data. And there are a number of points related to that. One person did point out that the registrant might not receive the notice because of the reseller problem, but didn't provide any further explanation as to what this reseller problem is.
There was a comment in one of the which I guess I would strongly disagree with, and the statement was something to the effect that the majority of people who have incorrect WHOIS information or unreachable WHOIS information do it deliberately to obfuscate who they are. And I would not want to characterize that as the majority in the cases that we're looking at of people of expiring names. There was one other... Does anyone else have any comments where I'm trying to remember what my other comment is?
Cheryl here, Alan.
Just
to note that there's a few things going on in chat other than very pithy comments, of course. So if anyone does, for example, want some of the stuff that we have access here in Australia that echoes what Mikhail were just saying, just perhaps let us know on the list, and perhaps some of us can do that exercise of sharing these examples anyway.
Okay. James?
I thought you were ready to issue a summary of question three, so I'll lower my hand until unless and until that occurs.
You're ready to disagree with the summary before I give it.
Not at all. I could have been, you know.
Weren't we all just filling in time while Alan worked out what he was going to say?
No,
you've got to take your opportunities, you know.
I will make this statement knowing full well what it says, but I've lost it. Again, I think we have a range of issues here from people saying things are working well. To statements that are a little bit fuzzier, certainly statements things not reaching the reseller because of the reseller problem is not something that I feel comfortable in responding to, because although I can think of reseller problems that I'm aware of, that statement doesn't quite make sense, and at least some of the comments. We're said in the form of my registrar gives me adequate notice, which I don't consider a blanket analysis, because we know from this group alone that some registrars obviously do give adequate notice.
Sorry, I'm away from my computer, Alan. Is anyone else's hand up?
No, James is now, but you started talking first.
Okay, Cheryl here. And of course, you know, one of the things we have discussed in this work group is we'd like to savvy up the end user. A little education will go a long way. And what those comments are saying is that some end users, registrants, are in fact savvy enough to go hunting about to find one that fits their needs. Well, that's a great thing. It doesn't, of course, mean that you don't have any risk to the less savvy end user and potential registrant.
I will say that I have done a little bit of analysis of my own on this particular one. I'm sorry, James had his hand up first. Then I'll put my hand up.
Yeah, and this is really more of a side topic, Alan, but I wanted to say that I do agree with your assessment that making the statement that the majority of folks use invalid WHOIS information are doing so on purpose, I think is probably an indicting statement that is probably not true, but I also think that maybe it's not our place in this particular phase of the working group to comment on the veracity of whether or not the commenter is actually, whether we agree or disagree. I just wanted to point that out. That's all.
Yeah.
Even though I agree with you, I think it's maybe not the right time.
On that particular topic, it may be true or not. The majority of people who have bad WHOIS information do it deliberately. I would strongly doubt if it's the case. In the cases we're looking at where people wanted to renew a name and weren't given notice. That's a conflict in terms, which I would disagree with whether it's right or not. One of the things that came up in my preparation for this is I went back to the RAA to say, what does it say about notices? Because we've had a lot of discussion in the working group on what kind of notices various registrars give prior to expiration and post-expiration. And I ended up finding the wording in the RAA, and it is, I will use the term curious at best. The only place the RAA talks about notices is it says, the original RAA prior to May said, you must send a second notice essentially at expiration time. I don't remember the exact wording. The revised RAA makes it a little fuzzier and says you must send a second notice prior to expiration, I think it says. Does anyone have any idea when you send the first notice? The RAA is silent on sending a first notice. The only way you know there are two is it talks about a second one. But there is absolutely no timing in the RAA about when this gets done. I believe the terms of the RA would be satisfied if you sent one a second, 2 seconds, and then 1 second before expiration, and they would be satisfied. So my perception is, regardless of what registrars are doing, the RAA itself is not very specific in saying what the obligations are. And as I noted in the email I sent before the last meeting, at least one registrar reseller that I've dealt with explicitly says we are not obliged to send any messages, but we may send one as a courtesy.
Yeah, well,
which is a violation of the RAA as far as I read it. McKaylee?
And Tim.
Yeah, I'm Tim after.
Well, look, if registrars are breaching the RAA and there is proof that the registrars are breaching the RAA, then surely that's a matter for compliance.
Indeed. Except in this particular case it was a reseller, but yes.
No, it's irrelevant whether it's a reseller. This throwing the reseller argument out every time isn't really valid, because ultimately the registrar is responsible for the actions of the reseller. The reseller has no contract with ICAM and is bound by the RAA, which has been signed by the registrar. So if the registrar's reseller or any other party who may or may not be doing things with domains isn't complying with the RAA, then ultimately it's a matter for compliance. At least that's my understanding of it.
If compliance can identify the case. Remember, compliance... does not know who the resellers are.
No.
But I'm not disagreeing with what you're saying at all.
No, sorry. With all due respect, it is clear which registrar is the registrar of record. If the registrar of record is in breach of the RAA, be that themselves or unknowingly through a third party, then surely it's a matter for compliance.
In theory, yes.
I don't see how it's in theory. If either the ICANN knows and everybody knows who the registrar of record for a domain name is, I don't see how it's either a matter for compliance or it isn't, because the reseller doesn't come in because they're not a contracted party.
Okay. I think this is a good one to take offline.
Can I just make a quick comment on that?
Yeah. Yes. Tim is next, then Ron.
I think the point is that in regards to something like this, that's true. It's difficult for compliance to know up front or to take the lead, so to speak, I guess, in saying, we can look at these particular resellers and tell whether or not they're compliant. I mean, that's difficult to do. But it's difficult to do with 900 registrars, and it's only going to get more difficult to do in the future with new GTLDs and who knows what happens with the separation issue and hundreds of more registrars. So I don't think it's any easier whether it's registrars or resellers as far as trying to, you know, monitor compliance ahead of any problems. But once a problem arises, then I think McKaylee is completely right that even if it's a reseller, there's a way to figure out who that reseller is reselling for. And the registrar is responsible for.
Yeah, I think we all agree on that.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Ron, you had your hand up. Did you?
That's my point. Yeah, it's covered. Thanks.
Okay. Now I'll give my summary so we can have an objection to it or an agreement. I would say this one is far from clear. Certainly, by contractually, there is no obligation to provide very adequate notice. The RAA simply doesn't call for anything. And I think we need to look at this a little bit further to say, should we be putting policy in place to require registrars to provide different types of notice, or is what we have satisfactory at the moment? So I think the discussion needs to be held. Without trying to prejudge the answer. Comments? Marika and I had side bets whether we'd finish this early. We may actually do that. Question 4. Was that agreeing with my summary or finishing early, Clara or Cheryl?
Well, actually, the summary, but I'm happy to do both.
Question 4.
Question four, whether additional measures need to be implemented to indicate that once a domain name enters the auto-renew grace period, it has expired. A number of people raise here that Whois data are unclear and are confusing because it shows an expiration date that has been extended by the registry. So a number of contributors here suggest that a change might be considered to that and using something like registered, expired, and some other terms to clarify that for registrants looking at that. Some talk as well about the notice on the website being mandatory, and someone suggesting as well that DNS deactivation should be mandatory upon expiration. So that's the comments received in that category.
I, without counting them, my impression was on this question we got more than the typical number of saying it is not clear and something needs to be done. Is that the what, Marika? Is that your overall impression also? Again, I didn't count.
Well, this was one where there were some concrete suggestions for changes. I think that was one of the differences with some of the other categories where people just said, yes, it's unclear or, there's not enough notice. But I think here, this is a category where some concrete suggestions were made by people about what, what could be changed or considered.
No, the implication being something should change. I have a question regarding the email discussion we had after the last meeting on the dates that registries and registrars may be showing. I don't have access to a domain which is in the process of expiring, so I don't have one where I can look at what's happening at the moment. Perhaps a registrar can provide us with some, or a registry, better still. Can someone tell me exactly what it says? I think it was Tim who made the statement that if you look at the data from the registrar who registered the name, it will be entirely clear what is going on. Can someone explain?
I'm not sure I quite put it that way, but...
No, well...
All I was trying to point out was that both are accurate to their intended audience. The who is at the registry is intended for its customers, which are the registrars. The registrar's who is intended for its customers, who are the registrants. So as each is looking at the who is intended for them, then you get an accurate picture.
Okay.
Now, as far as whether that's confusing or all these other kinds of issues, I'm not trying to comment on that, only that the intended recipients of the information, they're getting accurate information.
Okay, but I'm asking a more informative question, not to pass judgment. If I go to Network Solutions and query a domain which has just past expiration with GoDaddy, and they show me the full, forgive the expression, the thick, we're talking about a .com, let's say, and they show me the full thing, including all of the registrants' names, what expiration date do I typically see there? Anybody?
Well, this is Ron. I'll say in general, you do get the right information as the previous speaker pointed out. But the issue is that historically they agreed. So this is a change. Although a few years ago, it doesn't represent everyone being informed that the auto-renew change deviates from history. But further, it's the same term was used, even though that's, of course, this is getting into judgment whether it's clear or not, rather than what the actual practice is.
Well, but the question I was asking was I hope, simpler than that. Given that today we do have auto-renew with .com, if my domain expired 3 days ago, the registry will have auto-renewed for a year. So it's clear that the registry who is will say next year.
Mm-hmm.
If I go
now,
okay.
I can just say what GoDaddy does.
Okay.
And I think a number of other registrars we're aware of do something very similar. We, for .com, .net, we would show the who is that we have and the expiration date that's in our database, which would be, you know, it's already expired. But we do include a link to
the registry
who is that you can look at that'll show that the domain actually doesn't expire for a year.
Okay. Now,
whether that's confusing or not, maybe we need to relook at that. I don't know. But that's typically what we do. I think that's what you see with a lot of registrars.
But
when you get into thick registries, things get a little more complicated, of course. But because you've got some registrars who will just pull the data straight from the thick registry, and then thick registries won't even do the same thing. So it's
no, I understand, and we're just talking for this particular bit of the discussion, just for thin. But if I go to a generalized Whois service or to some other registrar, the only way they can get the name of the registrant is by going to the registrar's Whois data. I think that's correct.
That's correct, yeah.
So what date will they show? Are you saying they will have two dates to pick and they have to pick one of them?
I think typically registrars will show the date in their database. That isn't necessarily a hard and fast rule, but that's typically...
Well, what do you mean by their database? We're talking about a third party who's neither the registrar nor the registry.
Well, who can say what third parties do? I mean, they can do anything they want. That's one of the reasons why we put in certain limitations on our who is, so that we can limit what these third parties get. I mean, you know, because we don't know what they're going to do with that data or how they're going to display it. We're not particularly thrilled with third-party Whois services for that reason. I think it's hard for anybody to say what they typically do. There's so many of them.
But what you're implying is that another registrar or a non-affiliated Whois service may well provide the next year's date instead of the 3 days ago date.
You know, it doesn't matter what registrars or registries do. Third-party Whois providers are going to, they could do anything, right? So no matter what we do as far as policy is concerned, I don't think, you know, we should get too concerned about what third-party Whois services are going to do, because they can still do whatever they want.
I guess I would disagree. If I was having a problem with my registrar, I may well want to go to a third party and see what they say.
You may, but that third party can say whatever they want, is what I'm trying to tell you. Regardless of what is in anybody's database, they can make up their own stuff, right?
Well, they could indeed pick a date in the middle of the year or 6 years from now or 6 years ago, but assuming that... they're taking data that's coming in over the line from either the registrar or the registry. Jeff?
Hopefully, Tim, I can kind of clarify what you're saying, and I think I know what it is, that these independent services are not beholden to anyone to show valid information, and that's all I'm saying. They could put whatever they want, whatever it is, it could be completely wrong data. They could say, hey, we're going to do it this way because that's the way we like to show it. There's no rules for them. They're not contractually obligated. I think, is that, Tim, what you're trying to say? I think hopefully I'm trying to get at what you're trying to say about the third party there.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, I think that to me, you know, if a registrant goes to a third party, you know, to rely on that information, I think, is a fallacy, and they ought to be educated against it, in my personal opinion. Because we have no way of controlling what those third parties are going to display or show. That's exactly the point.
Okay, but...
Can I get in the queue, please?
Okay. I just want to clarify the question I was asking, and then we'll go back to the queue. Right now, if you go to a registry, Will they only for a thin registry? Will they only show you the registry data, or will they attempt to show you the whole data? If I go to VeriSign, I haven't tried it this moment, but
it's just registry data.
They will only show registry data. Okay, I don't know who I heard on the line trying to get in. Michele is the next one with his hand up.
And Barry.
Yeah. I mean, I think, look, ultimately a lot of this stuff comes back to education. I mean, at the moment, we're working on implementing so that we're compliant with the RAA. I mean, we're a relatively new registrar, so we've been relying on other people. And, you know, we could implement WHOIS in whichever way we wanted to, as long as we complied with contracts and everything else. And one of the points that I was trying to get across in the email exchanges during the week was that in some respects, a lot of this could be clarified possibly at the registry level if the flags in the WHOIS were clearer. Now, as Tim rightly pointed out, there is no way for anybody to know what a third-party WHOIS service is going to display. Another thing that you're forgetting about is that most registrars are going to run some form of rate limiting to protect their WHOIS server. So if for example, you are a very, very large registrar with, you know, several million names, your WHOIS server is going to be pounded all day long with legitimate requests. But if you see hundreds of thousands of requests coming from the same IP address, you're probably going to block or limit the number of queries that IP address is going to be able to perform, which means that the amount of data they're going to pull back, they'll probably end up caching it, so it could be out of date. It could be completely inaccurate. It's not going to be 100% reliable. Now, I would grant you the point that it's impossible really to know where somebody's going to go to look up the WHOIS data. So, I mean, it's kind of going round and round in circles. But, you know, ultimately, I think, you know, end-user education is probably the best solution to this.
Mikey?
I think there's people in front of me in the queue. Are there?
You're the only one with a hand up right now. I'm not sure who else to speak.
This is Barry. I'm not logged into Adobe.
Oh, okay. Okay, Barry then.
All right, thank you. This is Barry. So, you know, I think one way for us to look at this is not necessarily just from a registrant perspective, and regardless of whether it's third-party WHOIS or from a registry WHOIS, but, you know, there are other people out there in the market space that are looking for domain names and waiting for them to drop, as an example, or to expire in hope that they can acquire that. Yes, they can choose to back order them through their provider of choice, or they can choose to go the manual method. But in aspects to the openness and transparency, regardless of which WHOIS area that I'm going to look up, if I go to domain tools or I go to a registry database, if I'm going there and I'm not even a registrant and I want to be fully aware of when a domain expires and what's happening to it afterwards, often more than not what happens is that domain name expiration date gets updated because of the auto-renew, and so the person watching that sees that it was renewed, possibly, but they can't tell if it was renewed by the registrar as a service or if it was renewed by the registrant because they were on top of it. And so that's where the transparency starts to lose out. We don't have, whether you're a registrant or not, you don't have the visibility of what's really going on with that domain name. And so
Mikey?
I'll conclude my point.
Okay. Mikey?
I have to admit that I've been fooling around with domain names for a long time, and this was the first time I'd ever come across this divergence. So my question is really basic, and that is, you know, when I look at my domains right now, none of them are expired. The date's the same, and presumably that's the case most of the time between the registry and registrar databases, and that there's a limited period of time where those dates diverge. And I guess my question is that period where the
The registry database shows a year later. Is that the auto-renew grace period?
That is the auto-renew grace period, or the registrant has actually renewed. Is there anyone else still on this call, or am I alone?
No.
You're alone, Alan.
Okay.
It's that last part, Alan, that I guess I'm confused about. If the registrant has renewed, don't the databases converge again?
They should.
So
I'm sorry, you're asking when they diverge, what does it mean?
No. I just want to know what interval are they, do they diverge? Is it only the auto-renew grace period, or is there some other period?
Well, reportedly, although I don't have any specific cases, reportedly, if you renew for multiple years, some registrars will do the full renew with the registry and some will not. I don't know if that's fairy stories or it really happens, but that's another example that could where they could differ if it really happens.
I think that, you know, this
but that's not relevant to our discussion, however.
Right. This is just, it seems to me so basic that if we have a data, you know, I'm going to go into geek mode here. If we have a data element that has a different form, fit, and function than another data element with the same name, then at a minimum, we ought to change the name on one of those.
Agreed.
Why didn't anyone think of that at the beginning?
We're all rushing for our little green ticks, can I just say.
Sorry, I'm way behind the curve on this one. I had never heard of this before. I'm sorry I'm so out of the loop. But, you know, I guess, I have been fooling around with domain names for a long time, and if this is coming as a surprise to me, then surely there's one other person on the planet that's equally
good. Mm. Yep.
And it sounds like, from what Tim is saying, that from the registrar's point of view, there are two data elements in their database. The expiration date that they present to the registrant and the one they know the registry is holding. Tim, am I misstating something, or am I coming to a conclusion that's not true?
It's not in our database. I mean, when we just have a link to the registry who
okay,
is.
Okay, so you do it dynamically.
Yeah, now, you know, and our discussion here might be making an argument as to why it may not be a good idea, but you know, we don't store that in our database. We just the only date we have is the date of expiration according to our records.
On the other day, some other registrar may store them in their database.
Yeah, I can't answer that. But.
Mikey, are you in the queue again or still from the last time?
Oh, no, I'm dozing. Sorry.
Okay, Ron?
Yeah, and then this is like further afield, but just for clarity and transparency, I guess once the data is changed that you can get by going to who is, you can't ever say what it was a few minutes before. So, or is there a place that the public can go? Find out what it was a month ago or a year ago.
I don't think the web archives.
Ago.
I don't think the web archives caches who is.
Right. Mm. So if someone feels that they were abused by something, they have no way to demonstrate that they were abused. So.
Well, there may well be logs that are auditable somewhere in the world.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, and of course, the average registrant would have access to that knowledge.
Of course. the average registrant is at least three steps ahead of all of us here, so we have to assume they have a good grasp of these things.
Of course. Yes.
I think we've established significantly that there is some level of confusion. Whether it's a reasonable level of confusion, we can decide later, but I think there is some level of confusion. will anyone argue with me on that conclusion?
No, I'm confused, Alan. Go ahead.
I think we're on. We have 7 minutes and question number five to go. We will not end early.
Yeah, because we have as well a number of general comments. So question number five, whether to allow the transfer of a domain name during the RGP, reading the comments, I think there might have been some confusion, at least I interpreted the questions being, should registrants at the time of expiration be allowed to transfer the domain name to another registrar? And I think some of the commenters have interpreted the question differently, and seeing whether it should be transferred to someone else or. So there's a bit of a mixed bag. Some say it should not be allowed during RGP. Someone pointed out that the question is premature as transfer is not even allowed in the auto renew grace period, a point that Alan raised before. And some pointed out that the transfer should not be allowed apart from a transfer to the original registered name holder, which I presume assumes that it would go from a third party back to the RAE. So,
yeah, I think that one was referring to a different form of the word transfer, not transfer registrars, but transfer registrant.
Yeah.
So that one, I think, is a confusion in the terms. And I think we can discount that particular one. I would like to also discount the statements that say the registrant has no rights at the post-expiration, therefore the question is clearly they can't transfer it. I think there's well-established doctrine within ICANN that until, in the more traditional sense, until it was deleted and went through the RGP, the RAE, the original registrant, still does have some rights. Remember, we use terms here of owner, but in fact we're not selling an entity. We're registering it, and I think there's established principle, or we wouldn't be having this discussion at all, that post-expiration the RAE still does have some rights. We need to determine what they are and maybe change them, but I don't think we can take the stand that there are no rights at all.
Where do you see that one?
In the summary of the very first comment, question 5, registrants are not the owner of a domain name and should have no rights to it.
Well, I think, isn't there registrars?
Ah, sorry, you're right. It was actually said, though, somewhere, I believe, but sorry, I was misreading that one, so we can retract my dogma. I think there was an actual comment that did talk about that, saying post-expiration there are no rights, but you're right, it is not that one.
So the homework ate the dogma in this case.
I'm not sure I can even parse that one.
Oh, dear. Oh, quick, while Marika's on, he didn't get on with it.
Okay. To be honest, I don't feel very... I don't really want to have a substantive discussion about this one, because I don't think it comes up very often right now, and when we've established the rest of the rules that we want to change or not change, this one may be a more relevant question. I would prefer not to spend a lot of time discussing this one at the moment, though. Anyone desperately want a discussion in the next 3 minutes? All right, I would suggest that we defer the general comments to our next meeting. I would encourage, if anyone has any thoughts on the ones we've already covered, to continue it on email. I know there's one or two that I want to continue on that point. And our next meeting, are we meeting next week? Is there any reason not to meet next week? That would be October 6th. In the absence of any objection, we are meeting a week from now. I thank you all for your time. And let's continue on.
You just
want to
make sure you do finish early. Okay, Alan.
Well, we started 4 minutes late. We're finishing 2 minutes early. I think we're doing okay.
You've done all right.
Okay. I thank you all.
I still won the bet, Alan.
Pardon me?
I think I still won the bet.
I'll give that to you. I'll give that to you. Even if we didn't cover the general comments. And we're off before your mobile phone expires.
Oh, no,
it
expired.
It already did, and I already dialed back in.
Oh, dear, and I missed it.
I was right quick.
I foolishly opened the meeting view in a different tab this time, so I can't see it in parallel. Thank you all.
Bye.
Yeah.
Bye.
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 Bye.